Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. In today's episode, we are exploring one of the oldest ensembles in music history, the Ensemble of Human Voices, known as the Chorus. At the end of part one, we started discussing the choral works of Ludwig von Beethoven and his epic Ninth Symphony. A symphony usually implies a piece for orchestra only, but the budding trend at this time was to make the orchestra bigger. And there wasn't really much more that could be added at this time other than the kitchen sink. And the chorus was that proverbial kitchen sink that Beethoven throws in to make this symphony even more grand. Let's hear a recording by the Berlin Philharmonic with conductor Herbert von Karajan. This is a portion of the fourth and final movement, the movement which contains the famous Ode to Joy melody.
Thank you.
So that was Herbert von Karajan conducting the Berlin Philharmonic in a portion of the final movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which adds chorus and vocal soloists to a typically instrumental-only orchestration. Though Beethoven lived much of his life in what we call the classical era, this late and final symphony of his was really one of the great works of the next era, Romanticism. And in the Romantic era, grand choral orchestral works like this flourished. Not only were composers writing grand choruses in operas and great oratorios, but several would take cues from Beethoven and include a chorus in their symphonies. Though Beethoven was the first to incorporate the chorus into this traditionally instrumental type of piece, he would not be the last. Some of these composers who followed in Beethoven's footsteps were Felix Mendelssohn, who did this in his second symphony, Gustav Mahler, who did this in two of his symphonies, Sergei Rachmaninoff, who wrote a choral symphony called The Bells, and modern composers like Igor Stravinsky, who wrote a symphony of psalms, and these are just to name a few. But let's discuss a great choral orchestral masterpiece from the Romantic era by Brahms. On this program, we have discussed Johannes Brahms's German Requiem. In one episode, we used it to show how Brahms wrote a requiem in the language of the common people so that they could understand it, pulling text from inspirational passages of the Bible meant to comfort the living rather than prayers for the dead from the Latin liturgy. In this seven-movement work, four of them are purely for the chorus. The other three have chorus as well, but also feature a vocal soloist. We're going to hear the famous fourth movement, How Lovely Are Thy Dwelling Places. This is in German, but the text is taken from the first several verses of Psalm 84. Eric Leinsdorf conducted the Boston Symphony and the New England Conservatory Chorus in that recording of the fourth movement of a German Requiem by Johannes Brahms. Brahms's German Requiem is one of the great choral masterpieces in all the standard repertoire, and it's an example of the many choral orchestral works being composed in the 19th century. On the other side of the spectrum to the choral orchestral works was Brahms's Liebeslieder Waltzes, a set of pieces for chorus and piano, and the piano part is for four hands, so a piano duet. They are love songs based on the work of German poet Georg Friedrich Daumer. Here is the sixth waltz from the Opus 52 set in a recording by the Robert Shaw Festival Singers with conductor Robert Shaw and pianist Norman McKenzie and John Wustmann. This is Ein kleiner hübscher Vogel, or A Little Charming Bird. So that was the Liebeslieder Waltz, Opus 52, Number 6, by Johannes Brahms, about a little charming bird, performed by the Robert Shaw Festival Singers with conductor Robert Shaw and pianists Norman McKenzie and John Wustmann. Later in the Romantic era, we have a famous composer of much great piano music, Sergei Rachmaninoff, but he also made some powerful contributions to the choral repertoire. One large-scale choral work was his choral symphony mentioned earlier, The Bells, plus an utterly beautiful unaccompanied work called All Night Vigil, sometimes referred to as Vespers, which premiered in 1915 and became one of Rachmaninoff's favorite works among all his own output. One of the most beautiful moments in this work is the sixth movement. The text is in Russian, based loosely on Luke 1, verse 42, but listen to the beautiful long lines in the melodic writing. It's glorious how he has both the soprano and tenor sections singing in octaves at one point, while the other voices harmonize underneath. And then there is this purely Romantic era idea of a golden section, a place to where everything builds and climaxes, and afterward everything settles back down in serenity.
Thank you. Hi, I'm composer Eric Whitaker, and you're listening to Music for Life on KPCG.
So that was a gorgeous late Romantic era example of how the chorus was being utilized at this time period. But that was in a purely unaccompanied way in that work by Rachmaninoff. Still, we heard the Romantic era ideals, such as long melodic lines and a climactic golden section to which everything built. That was a recording by the Robert Shaw Festival Singers. As we move into the modern era, we would be remiss not to mention one of the choral masterpieces by Karl Orff. We discussed Orff on previous episodes for his innovation in the field of music education, but his claim to fame as a composer came from a choral orchestral work called Carmina Burana. This is a cantata based on various medieval poetry. This piece even uses a children's chorus briefly in one of the movements. But we're going to hear the final two movements of this powerful work. The text is in Latin and on mythological subjects, but listen to how the chorus is utilized in this modern era and the presence of more percussion and percussive qualities, which was a characteristic common in this time period.
Thank you.
So that was an example of a choral masterpiece of the 20th century, Karl Orff's Carmina Burana. Those were the final two movements in a recording by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra and Chorus under the baton of Leonard Slatkin. Moving later into the 20th century, there are two British composers I feel compelled to mention. One was John Tavener. Tavener was born in 1944 and was launched into musical prominence in his 20s when he was dubbed by The Guardian as the musical discovery of the year. This was in 1968, the year of the premiere of his work, The Whale, a dramatic cantata very loosely based on the account of Jonah. Throughout his life, he was known mostly as a prolific composer of religious choral music. He gained even more exposure, global exposure, in 1997 when one of his works was performed at the funeral of Princess Diana, which we're hearing a little of here by the Westminster Abbey Choir. John Tavener died in 2013. He was described by a fellow composer as having the very rare gift of being able to, quote, bring an audience to a deep silence, unquote. The composer who said that about Tavener was the other contemporary British choral composer I want to talk about, John Rutter. Rutter was born in 1945 in London and is still living at the time of this recording. His compositions are mainly choral, and they are extremely popular among the choral community. He is well known for his Requiem, but also for his dozens and dozens of anthems and standalone choruses. Back in 2004, the Philadelphia Church of God's Philadelphia Singers, headquartered right here in Edmond, Oklahoma, recorded a John Rutter chorus on its album Bring in the Harvest. Here is that recording, accompanied by a studio orchestra. This is Lord, Make Me an Instrument of Thy Peace.
Thank you.
So that was an example from John Rutter, his chorus, Lord, Make Me an Instrument of Thy Peace, recorded by the Philadelphia Church of God's Philadelphia Singers back in 2004, performing with a studio orchestra. I want to talk about another living composer of choral music, but let's actually talk to him. This is our Backstage Banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. This is Sleep, a choral composition by Grammy-winning American composer Eric Whitaker. This piece is also conducted by him, and it's being performed by an ensemble that he conceived known as the Virtual Choir, sometimes called the YouTube Choir. Though his virtual choirs have gone viral and brought him to international renown, he is highly respected as a conductor of some of our generation's finest choral music. Would you talk about your background as a young choir member? And I guess in your case, that was in college, right?
That's right. I had never sung in choir growing up, admittedly, because I thought choir people were kind of nerdy, and especially choirs in general with the outfits. It just wasn't my thing. And I played pop music in high school. I didn't read music. And when I went to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, I joined choir to meet girls. And it was there that I first sang the Requiem by Mozart. And on that very first day, my life was completely transformed, and I became then the world's biggest choir geek.
And what kind of artistic outlet does being in a choir afford you as a performer?
Well, I have to say it's been years since I've really had a chance to sing in a choir. We've just moved back to Los Angeles, and for the past 5 years, we've been in Cambridge, England. I was resident composer there at Cambridge University, and a couple of times I got to sing in the choir there, and I'd forgotten how extraordinary that experience is. I really miss it. The thing that I remember most about it was the sense of peace and connectedness. I remember that very distinctly, that this sense that we were all breathing together, that we were all in this together, that there was a common goal, and that there was this energy in the room. I haven't found anything like it anywhere.
Just as a composer in general, what does writing music do for you in terms of your artistic outlet?
I've been thinking about this a lot lately for some reason. In some ways, it's a compulsion. And in that it's a compulsion, it's not always fun. Right? And so it's not that it's this thing like, oh, well, I just can't wait to go write music. It's that I am compelled to make it. And I think the reason for that is that there is this, well, you can even tell as I'm stumbling through this interview, that oftentimes I find the spoken language to be a blunt instrument for expression and for communication. It's difficult for me to sometimes communicate large emotional and structural ideas that I have, that I feel through words. But somehow music offers this very dense, graceful, pure language that somehow remains intact, that I write it a certain way, and then others hear it or perform it, and there seems to be most, if not all, of the information transferring from one person to another. And so oftentimes I really wish I could just communicate with the world through music and not through the spoken word. Music is a language that just it just works.
Mm-hmm. What kind of artistic outlet does being a composer of choir music offer you?
Well, in a sense, it's exactly the same thing that I get as a performer, is that what I'm hoping to do is to write the notes in the right combination so that it creates a sense of community, a communal experience, so that these singers, it's not that they're all feeling the same thing at the same time, but that everyone has a shared intention. And so my goal as a composer is to find, like I said, the right combination of words and notes so that when everyone breathes together, this other thing comes to life, this thing that's bigger than each of the individuals in the choir.
How does your role as a composer inform your conducting process? Obviously, you do a lot of conducting, and I'm thinking particularly as you conduct choirs or as you teach choirs, obviously that composer's perspective would affect your conducting, would it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It also works the other way, that since I've been conducting, I've become much, much more pragmatic in my composition. There's one way to write that is, it's an abstraction in a way, that it looks amazing on the page and it works structurally within everything else that's happening, but it's just a beast to perform and it's not worth it. So now that I've become a conductor, I try to write things as simply and elegantly as I possibly can on the page, so that in a way the music is conductor-proof, that it doesn't rely on the conductor. That, for instance, it took me years to realize even this very simple idea that if you want the choir to get louder, just bring them higher in their register. If you want them to get softer, bring them lower in their register. All the crescendos and fortes and allegandos in the world don't really matter on the page if it's not ergonomically happening. Right. And for me, the best music is the stuff that you sort of just add water and it more or less does what it's supposed to do. And I've been hugely informed by having to struggle with other pieces and my own pieces as a conductor, just trying to put them together. Now, also, I find as a composer, I try to make it as clear as possible to myself as a conductor later on or to future conductors. I try to be, and that doesn't necessarily mean more information. I find lots of scores just overmarked. It's not that it's just that what is the intention? What is the musical intention, the dramatic intention, and how can I best say that in the fewest possible gestures? Speaking of choral music and why I love singers so much, it's something that Schoenberg, of all people, said, which was that, I'm paraphrasing, but basically that a phrase is any group of notes that can be performed in one breath. I think this all the time, that there's something so magical and transcendent and fundamentally human about simply breathing together. That's it. And as a composer and as a conductor and as a performer, for me, everything originates with the breath. I'm sure you've found as conductors, so many tuning issues, balance issues, ensemble issues can all be fixed with just a single unified breath. Everybody takes that same breath with that intention and everything comes clear. And I never get tired of that moment standing in front of a group where I'm in the right place, they're in the right place. We take that breath together and boom, it's just, for me, it's everything. It sums up the whole game. And by the whole game, I mean really life in general. It's just that moment. And I think it's why I'm drawn endlessly to choral music, because there's moment after moment of transcendence, just as you're performing. Also, as a total other aside, just choir people are the best. You know, I love orchestras, I love bands, I love all kinds of different ensembles. But, you know, choir people, it's as social as it is a gig. And so, you know, choir people are, they're always there ahead of time. And then they always stay afterwards for coffee or beer. And choirs always hold hands at the end of the season and cry as they sing together. You know, it's just, I just like choir people. Yeah, and so somehow that seems to be infused in the music itself, too. Not just mine, but good choral music in general seems to allow that in people, that they can be close and soft.
Yes, that's brilliant. This has been really great talking with you, Eric. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
See you, man.
See ya.
Let's hear more of this choral work by Eric Whitaker, our guest for today's Backstage Banter, as performed by his virtual choir 2.0. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. In today's episode, we are exploring one of the oldest ensembles in music history, the ensemble of human voices known as the chorus. Finally, let's have our dessert, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program. A great deal of choral repertoire comes from a folk tradition known as the Negro spiritual tradition. These are religious-themed songs created by African slaves in the United States during the 19th century. The Christian themes of these work songs are metaphors for the trials of slavery and hopes for freedom. Though these folk songs would have been conceived as just singular melodies, they are commonly performed today as choral arrangements. Here is the Moses Hogan Chorale performing Moses Hogan's arrangement of Great Day.
Great Day.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.